Good evening, everyone. How's that for volume? Good evening, everyone. Welcome to KPMG. My name is Michael Bray, and I chair the KPMG Energy and Natural Resources practice in both Australia and Asia Pacific. And our speaker tonight and the subject matter is of great interest to that practice. In that practice, we focus on mining, oil and gas, power and utilities, and particularly some of the large projects in LNG and mining that are going on, energy policy, energy markets and energy financing, and very importantly, the investment and trade ties that we have with Asia Pacific and China specifically. So it's my great pleasure to welcome you all to KPMG, and with that, hand over to Michael McKellar.
Thank you very much indeed, Mike. It's a great pleasure for us to be associated with KPMG, and thank you very much indeed for putting on such a splendid spread. You know it's a splendid spread when it's hard to get people away from it to come and sit down. Now, tonight we have a rare opportunity to hear, not a rare opportunity, but an opportunity to hear somebody who is at the top of his game. I speak in grand final terms, of course. Professor Jeff Raby, who is a Monash Professorial Fellow, and he's also an independent non-executive director of and advisor to companies with interests in China. Why on earth would he do that? One of the reasons he'd do that is because he's been ambassador to China for some years now, and before that he was a trade negotiator. So he not only knows China extremely well, but he also lives there, and that's taking immersement in the local scene to its absolute limits. China's been in the news a little bit lately, as you may have noticed, and it's extraordinarily important to us in Australia, and it's extraordinarily important to the world as a whole, as we look not only at the commercial operations that take place there, but as we look at the shifting balances of power which are taking place throughout, particularly our region of the world. We couldn't find anybody, I can't think of anybody, who knows more about this than a former ambassador, a person who has been involved in trade negotiations, and now, as I say, is living up there and advising companies on how to deal with China, to speak to us tonight on China, political changes and challenges. Professor Jeff Raby.
Thank you, Michael. I'd like to join with you to thank KPMG for making this event possible and the Australian Institute of International Affairs Victoria Branch for including me in your very impressive speakers program. I'm 2 months out of the stocks, as it were, after 27 years as a public servant. I'm just starting to learn that it's possible to move my arms and twist my head in a different direction. So I'm relishing the relaxation of some of the constraints. For that reason, tonight I'm going to speak about a subject which I hadn't as an ambassador or as a senior member of the Department of Foreign Affairs. Felt comfortable in delving too deeply in public forums. Obviously, internally within government, I've written and commented on these matters for many years. And that is China's political system and situation. And there isn't a great deal of this sort of public discussion. The sinologists, the people that study the tea leaves inside the central leadership compound of Zhongnanhai, these are very fine academics who debate with each other, but there's not a lot in the popular media or the quality media or in public forums, to my mind, that tries to work through some of these big issues. So given that there's a major political transition going to take place next year in China, I thought it was timely for me to have a go at speaking on this subject. Some of you who know me would have expected me to talk about economic or trade matters, and I'm certainly very happy to pick up those in the question and answer session. I've called my presentation this evening China's 2012 Political Transition because it really is a big thing. Late next year, a major change in formal leadership positions in China will occur. There was a time not long ago, when such an event would attract little comment or attention other than amongst what I call the Zhongnanhai-ologist, a play on criminologist. Today it goes without saying that what happens in Chinese politics is of major global significance. The lead up to the third post-Deng Xiaoping generational change in Chinese politics will be analysed and debated, and the new leadership will be minutely scrutinised within and outside China. For a country as deeply dependent on China as is Australia, the stakes are particularly high. China takes over 25.5% of our exports, more than any other country does. We, in turn, are more dependent on China than any comparable developed country, more so even than Japan and South Korea, and significantly more so than Europe or the United States. Not only is China our biggest export market and trading partner by a wide margin, but it is also our most important services market. China is the main source of fee-paying foreign students and the biggest tourist market in terms of spending, and the second in terms of number of visitors. China's direct to foreign investment in Australia, as we know so well, continues to increase rapidly. So what happens in China politically will have a major and direct bearing on Australia's economic outlook, as well as broader regional security concerns. This means that to an important extent, Australia's future is linked to a political system of which we know very little about its inner workings. While China's economic and geopolitical weight in the world has inexorably increased, its political system remains as obscure and opaque as it was, as it has always been since the Communist Party took power in 1949. In an important book by Richard McGregor published earlier this year called simply The Party, he described China's Communist Party as the power behind the screen. It is everywhere, but it is difficult to see and is certainly beyond scrutiny. In a reference to Empress Dowager Cixi Xi, the party can be heard but cannot be seen, yet it is all-powerful. China continues to be a one-party authoritarian state. Notwithstanding 33 years of economic reform, economic opening and ever deeper integration into the international economic and political systems, by comparison, China's domestic political institutions and organisations have gone through remarkably little fundamental change. China is certainly a vastly different world in terms of individual freedoms from the one I experienced firsthand when I served at the Australian Embassy on my first two assignments during the years 1986 to 1991. Then, the state and party interfered in the detail of daily personal life, assigning people to jobs, approving marriages, restricting travel within China, and preventing overseas travel unless authorised, not to mention the very rigid enforcement of the one-child policy. The state meddled to a suffocating, mind-numbing, boredom-inducing degree with everything from restrictions on personal entertainment to fashion and hairstyles. A few years ago, in a speech to the Lowy Institute in Sydney, I used the French phrase, plus ça change, to describe the situation I found on returning to China in 2007. The more things had changed in the society and economy, the more, in fact, they had stayed the same in terms of political and social organisation. The strong line of continuity was, of course, the Communist Party and its continuing grip on political power. Not that the Communist Party itself is unchanging. It has shown remarkable resilience, surviving and then largely reinventing itself following the twin existential crises it faced at the end of the 1980s, namely the collapse of Soviet communism at first in Eastern Europe and then in Russia, and then the Tiananmen debacle when the People's Liberation Army was used against the people. Then, throughout the 1990s, it learned to embrace capitalism. Party Secretary Jiang Zemin won a hard-fought internal struggle to allow capitalists to become party members. Premier Zhurong Ji won another decisive struggle to submit China to the rule of international law, which would constrain certain types of state behaviour when China acceded to the WTO. An expansion of markets, foreign penetration of the economy. For example, in 2004, Nicholas Lardy, a Yale economist at the time, estimated that at that time, China was more open as a developing economy than were either Japan or South Korea, contemporary Japan or South Korea, as developed economies. The party has also managed an ever-widening income inequality. Somehow, all of these things have been internalised and hence legitimised by the party. Post the traumas of 1989-19, the party which emerged was clearly not a Soviet-style, ossified, kleptocratic, insular-closed elite. In China, the party set about learning from its own past mistakes, particularly the Cultural Revolution, and especially those of the failed Russian and European Communist parties. It has performed a remarkable feat of renewal and rejuvenation through internal study and training, and, among other things, handsomely resourced party schools which resemble MBA institutions in the West rather than centres of Marxist-Leninist orthodoxy. During the 1990s, Jiang Zemin set about establishing a new implicit social contract for the party's control and exercise of power and for government. The state would withdraw from the daily detail of people's lives and from the management and running of enterprises and deliver rising standards of living by a single-minded concentration on economic growth. In return, the role of the party, as well as political figures and their families, was not to be challenged. Increasingly, criticism of the government has indeed been tolerated when it relates to poor performance, but not to its unchallenged power. The party is still off limits, as in any attempt to organise opposition through group action. These are the red lines that define Chinese politics today. In the run-up to the 2008 Olympics, the state systematically and deliberately set about tightening political control. Month after month, word spread of new measures, mostly unannounced, about the ways in which the security services were clamping down. Foreigners too were caught up in this, from sudden, unexplained visa restrictions to door-to-door visits, I must say, mostly by polite police, checking foreigners' mandatory registrations. By the time of the Games, everything was pretty much screwed down. Many thought that these things would ease up and return pretty much to the situation of the previous years after the Games. While that may have happened for foreigners, there seems to have been little change for locals, especially those with a past record of dissident activities. Perhaps with a view to the next round of leadership changes, the authorities seem to have sustained the pressures. Whereas the red lines of acceptable challenge to authority and dissent may have been contracting to some extent prior to the 2008 tightening, since then they seem to have been pushed out. The settings, however, are not fixed and are subject to internal political contest. The area of individual rights, the role of rights lawyers and advocates and the media have all been subject to contest in recent years and have seen a definite rollback of earlier, somewhat more relaxed attitudes. The taking into custody earlier this year of the high-profile activist artist Ai Weiwei sent a strong public message that the red line was being set in a more restricted direction. In view of Ai Weiwei's high profile within China and internationally, I, for one, and many others, were convinced that he would only re-emerge into the light of day after serving a stiff prison sentence. That he didn't suggests that those arguing for a greater degree of relaxation had for the moment prevailed. But since his release, numbers of other rights lawyers, environmental activists and media have all fallen under renewed pressure. These boundaries would seem to be highly contested at present. Ai Weiwei's case is instructive to the extent that we can really understand what was behind it when compared with that of Liu Xiaobo, Liu was sentenced in the face of stiff international protests to 11 years in prison for organising a democracy petition and demonstration in late 2008. Subsequent to his imprisonment, he was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize. The determination of the leadership to press on with such a tough sentence in Liu's case suggests that organising opposition or group protests, especially in the name of democracy, clearly crosses a highly sensitive and probably a less contested red line. Its opacity and limits notwithstanding, Chinese politics are dynamic. Within the centres of power, we know that fierce contests are waged between individuals, families and factions. We can only just peer into this enough, as well as make guesses, to understand that rivalries entail a very human, Shakespearean mix of ambition, greed, jealousy, and also legitimate policy differences. Much analysis and discussion of foreign domestic commentators on China's contemporary political contests focus on a supposedly two-line struggle between what are called princelings, those born into the leadership by virtue of their parents' pre-1949 revolutionary pedigree, and those of the Communist Youth League, who are generally assumed to be officials who have worked their way up through the party's ranks without family patronage. Hu Jintao, the current president, is seen as a leader of this latter group. Another factional division is, or was until Hu imposed his authority over his aged and weakened rival, was geographically defined between the Shanghai clique and others. Jiang Zemin, the former party secretary, led the Shanghai group, which was seen to be in opposition to Hu Jintao. But as in all political contexts, it is equally clear that there are constantly shifting allegiances and overlapping and cross-cutting alliances. Others have suggested that lineal political patronage trumps all other considerations. These matters, as we know, are studied at length by people much more knowledgeable of the subject and better equipped than me to comment. So it's not my intention to provide a micro-analysis of this, but to reiterate two points. The first is how little we really know about the inner tensions and alliances at the centre of China's politics. And secondly, the sense that party politics, despite the forced, calm facade presented to the Chinese people and the world at large, is in a constant state of flux. It is to be expected, and there's certainly evidence of this, that the pushing and shoving is intensifying as we approach the period in which final decisions will be made to settle the leadership positions at the 18th Party Plenum to be held next October 2012. Politics has always been played out in Communist China through the use of proxies and surrogates, which supplement more direct challenges and advances. So the experts who study these things must interpret a lot of indirect signals as well. The skills of the political tea leaf readers are as necessary and as valuable as they ever have been. Indeed, given China's now singular importance to Australia bilaterally and to the world at large, these skills are perhaps even more vital. In looking at the political contests in China in the lead up to the next leadership transition, it should be borne in mind that those at the centre of the system all seek to perpetuate the system, and with it, of course, theirs and their families' perks and benefits. The trauma of Tiananmen Square in 1989 forcefully demonstrated to the leadership that you either hang together or you hang separately. The choice successive generations of political elites has made is clearly obvious. Speculating on the leadership transition is not, however, quite as fraught with the risk of getting it wrong as punting on the outcomes of next Saturday's grand final here in Melbourne, but it is tricky just the same. What we do know is that at the Party Congress in late 2007, Vice President Xi Jinping and Executive Vice Premier Li Keqiang were appointed to their current positions, and in doing so were effectively anointed as the future President and Premier. A year later, she was appointed to the deputy chairmanship of the Central Military Commission. This was both within and outside China seen as PLA endorsement for his taking on the number one position. barring some major indiscretion or scandal, neither of which seemed to be in the makeup of Xi's character, the way would seem to be clear for him. Xi is a princeling with an impeccable family lineage in the party and military, going back to the Yan'an days through his father. Li Keqiang is typical of the younger generation of leader who has come up through the party's Communist Youth League. He's well educated, technocratic, and supremely confident in his own abilities and of China's destiny. So much work has been done over the past 4 years since the 17th Party Congress, which anointed them to prepare the succession, that for one or the other, let alone both, not to get up in the end would signal major political instability at the centre of China's politics. My money, for all it's worth then, is on both smoothly, at least in appearance to the outside world, moving up. Nonetheless, rumours persist that some rumours with high probabilities being asserted that the elder Vice Premier Wang Qishan could well pip Li and take the Premier's spot. Wang is said to be part of the princelings as his father-in-law is Yao Yilin, Long March veteran and 1980s Vice Premier. Were this to occur, however it was presented, it would inevitably be interpreted, whether correctly or not, within and outside China, as a major setback for Hu Jintao and the Communist Youth League faction. Repercussions would cascade down through the all-powerful Standing Committee of the Party Central Committee and so on, possibly even to key provincial level appointments. More open, in my view, is the Standing Committee. It would seem that membership of this after next year's 18th Party Congress is still not settled. Again, there is much we don't know. Currently it has 9 members, but in the past it had 7. And there are no fixed rules. As there are no fixed rules, we should not assume that because the last 2 times it has had 9 members, it will continue to do so in future. Perhaps the safest bet with respect to size is that it will have an odd number. Similarly, although the PLA has not been represented on recent standing committees, there is no reason to assume this will continue. In the past, the PLA has been on the standing committee. It may well return to the next. Were this to happen, especially outside China, this would be interpreted as a strong negative signal that the power of the military was increasing at the expense of civilian politicians. In practice, in my view, it makes little difference given the close links at the top of the party and the power and prestige of the military inside the party, whether or not it holds formal office, such as a seat on the Standing Committee. 3 of the leading contenders for the Standing Committee are well known and have, in different ways, declared their own hand. Bo Xilai is a media-savvy, high-profile political figure with impeccable revolutionary family credentials. He is currently party secretary of the huge far western metropolis Chongqing. His move there after the 17th Party Congress from his national level position as Minister for Commerce was seen by many as a demotion, by some as a move sideways. Whatever, he has cleverly used a series of highly publicised anti-mafia campaigns to burnish his claims for advancement. Wang Yang, Bo's predecessor in Chongqing, is seen as Bo's main rival. Wang is the party secretary of Guangdong province and an exemplar of the Communist Party Youth League. His power in Guangdong was entrenched in recent years following a number of high-level officials from Guangdong and Shenzhen being charged and imprisoned over corruption. It is believed that the campaign against corruption in Guangdong was directed by President Hu personally. The 3rd obvious candidate is the current party secretary of Shanghai, Yu Jiangcheng. Yu is believed to have the strong backing of Jiang Zemin's allies and is aligned with the princelings. Beyond these high-profile candidates, many more names circulate and all sorts of combinations and complexions are possible. It's not possible today to say who will prevail with any degree of confidence. At least I feel unable to do so. We have a bit over 1 year to go before we will know for sure. Most likely, though, by the northern spring of next year, rumours will start to firm up around a number of names. But uncertainty is likely to persist until October and the 18th party plenum itself. But while we may know names and have a certain understanding of the dynamics and alliances, we know next to nothing of what this means in terms of future Chinese government policies. One is reminded that when Hu Jintao became president, many thought because of his patronage lineage to the more liberal reformer Hu Yaobang via the Communist Party Youth League, economic and political reform would be nudged along under his tenure. Whether the major achievements, whatever the major achievements of China under Hu's leadership, political reform especially, has not been one of them. Moreover, we probably expect too much of the leader in China these days, long gone as the great helmsman and the charismatic individual. The Standing Committee functions as best we know on the basis of consensus. To understand the policy implications of China's leadership transition will require an understanding of each of its members when appointed and how their views are reconciled between themselves collectively. From an Australian perspective, through the active bilateral relationship we have pursued with China, we know all the main actors well. All of the key people have visited Australia at some time. Many have been frequent visitors. China's most likely next president, Xi Jinping, has visited every mainland state of Australia. I'm not sure how many other world leaders could make the same claim. Although we have met, spent time and worked with many of these political figures, it is still the case that we really don't know who they are in policy terms and how they will behave once in power. Returning to the theme at the beginning of this presentation, if China was small and relatively isolated, as it was until a decade or so ago, discussing the 2012 leadership transition would still be a boutique academic activity. This is patently no longer the case. Last Friday, commodity markets and exchanges around the world more generally went into a big sell-off when China's PMI, the Purchasing Managers Index, fell below the benchmark 50 points. Imagine what the markets would do if Xi Jinping did not emerge as China's next president in a year's time. Thank you.
Well, Jeff has kindly accepted to take questions. Who would like to ask the first question? We have a roving microphone. Peter's taking it. Who's got the first question? Zara Kipton. I didn't welcome you, Zara, our National Vice President. Lovely to see you here.
Is that working?
Yes.
You did say that you would take some questions about the economy as well.
Sure.
I was just reading the Economist this afternoon. It said it would be healthy if the developing world could break the rich world's monopoly on international finance. Emerging markets account for almost half world GDP but have no reserve currency of their own. The longer it takes for the yuan to emerge, the more risky the global financial setup will become. Could you comment on that?
The short answer is I agree. The more developed answer is that it's very interesting that I think the renminbi yuan is being internationalized quite quickly now. Quicker than policy announcements from the centre would indicate, emanating from China, and more quickly, I think, than most people recognise. Just in the last 6 months, the level of renminbi deposits in Hong Kong have increased dramatically. Renminbi bilateral trade account settlements are beginning to occur bilaterally between China and Malaysia and Uruguay, Argentina, other countries. This is something we should do and engage in, I believe, and it's something the ANZ Bank has conducted work on and published reports on. So I think that this is we're at the beginning of a very significant and new development in China and the world economy. This is not about the renminbi replacing the US dollar as the global reserve currency. I don't think that is on the cards for a very long time, and it's not really the point. The point is, I think, to be alert and aware of the speed at which the renminbi is being internationalised. The other side of that is that China will have to liberalise its capital account more quickly as well. And there's a whole lot of financial sector reform that will have to be dragged through with that. Why are they doing it now? I think just the huge imbalances in the world economy and their understanding of the negative consequences for China if they unwind too far. Secondly, domestically they're under enormous pressure, inflation's high, there are a lot of there's no real avenues for saving, real interest rates are negative. There's some things they can do, but one thing they can do is renminbi appreciation and allow renminbi to flow out, yuan to flow out of China more easily than it does. And the next point beyond that, just in terms of the consequences, is I think you need to get ready for two things. One is an even bigger increase of Chinese capital outflow, and particularly new players emerging, such as very wealthy private high net worth individuals, and also a strengthening of Hong Kong's role as a major financial centre in the world.
Deb.
Jeff, Melbourne is sister city with Tianjin, and my question relates to the view of the sister city relationships. There are many sister city relationships with Australian cities and Chinese cities. I just was interested in a comment from you as to the importance of these to China.
I've become a big fan of them. When I was Deputy Secretary looking after North Asia in DFAT, looking after China, part of the brief, I was fairly, not so much sceptical, but I just thought, well, how do they fit into the bigger picture of things? Since being 4.5 years on the ground as ambassador in China and being involved with promoting a number of these and seeing how they work, I really think they do a lot. I think one of the things from our point of view is that it gives us a raised profile in a city. And this matters a lot. One of the themes of my ambassadorship, and some of you will be aware of that, is to try and direct attention of people in Australia, particularly government in Australia and business, away from the Chinese eastern littoral and the big three, Beijing, Shanghai and Guangdong, to what's called second and third tier cities. Now, in the past, I mean, Tianjin, we've just celebrated the Tianjin Melbourne, I think, 25 year or 30 year or something, it's fantastic. That was one of those sort of, optional extras you might do in government. But to Melbourne's credit and Tianjin's credit, both sides have worked at it and built it and kept it going. Now, Tianjin is a really significant growing city, and Melbourne has a particular profile there, and I think it provides a tremendous opportunity for Melbourne businesses to leverage off that relationship. And I think you see it elsewhere throughout China, and I've been, in my latter year or so, quite active. An Australian city already has one Chinese relationship, trying to encourage them to think creatively about new relationships, not necessarily the full sister city bells and whistles model, but some special sister city relationship. Because on the Chinese side, and I guess the last point I'd make on this is we have to understand now the whole world's beating a path to China's door. And whereas it was sort of easy for us, and there was a time when we once got China, I'm not so sure it's the case today, we were there, we had a presence and a profile, and there wasn't the competition for attention. Now everyone's there, and we're getting crowded out all over China. Sister city relations are one way of having that profile, and I strongly encourage councillors and their constituents to look favourably at this as a very important vehicle to raise the profile of your city in China, but more than that, to provide a very helpful framework for your city's businesses to expand into China.
There's more.
Thank you, Jeff, for that presentation. I want to ask you about the internal, potential internal problems, not within the party in Beijing, but in China generally. We had a visit not so long ago from the head of the, former head of the Uyghurs, who's now in Washington, and there is obvious tension between the Han in China and other, I don't know whether you call them races or what you call them. I'd be very interested to hear, and also one hears about a lot of disturbances locally that seem to penetrate into the Australian press, presumably partly about property rights, which do not seem to have developed from what one sees from the outside. And if they don't develop, there's obviously going to be tension as the economy grows and incomes per head grow. That's my question. My second question is Mr. Rudd still welcome in China?
I'm no longer part of the government, but I won't answer the second one. On the first one, it's a very, very important question, and had the speech not been getting a bit too long, I did want to touch on some of those issues. Just to be clear, though, about Rabia Kadir, the Uyghur, she is a self-appointed head of an overseas group of exiled Uyghurs. Uyghurs in China don't see her as any... She's not like the Dalai Lama. There's a terrible confusion, I think, in media reporting. Most people in Melbourne would never have heard of her, and probably never have heard of a Uyghur, until she turned up at the film festival in 2009. And courtesy of the Chinese Consul General here, who made such a mess of it, no one would have heard of her either. I mean, so it's a very complex set of history and cultural and ethnic issues around it. Badly understood, but frankly, it's a classic case of shooting yourself in the head. And I think this year, with both the Dalai Lama's visit and her repeat visit to Australia, the Chinese officials have learned to be more sophisticated and to show a greater understanding of Australia's own political system and values. And I think that's what upsets people most when the Chinese officials behave in that heavy-handed way. It often doesn't go to the substance of the issue. It's that we see in Australia that the Chinese officials are not respecting our values and systems, and that there's a legitimate area for people to feel irritated over. Now, on the rest of it, I describe China as being in a permanent, steady state of instability. Every day there are thousands of demonstrations and protests, but there's not evidence to me that these coalesce around, although they might have a common cause, and you're correct, it's not so much about land rights, although that is a big issue, it's about arbitrary behaviour, corruption, lack of due process, lack of transparency, lack of accountability. I'll come back to land rights in a second, but that's really what gets people out on the streets, even though this spark might have to do with a property development project. But none of them seem to coalesce in a movement, if you like. In many ways, the Communist Party has been brilliant in putting itself between those events and the people, and basically presenting itself as the solution, not the cause of the problem. And so far, people haven't joined the dots. The cause of the problem is not so much lack of property rights, but a lack of rule of law. So in China, you have rule by law, but there is not a rule of law. That is, the Communist Party is not subject to any law that it wishes not to be subject to. And that is the fundamental dilemma of China today. And that's the challenge that I don't think there is an easy answer for. And all these other things are a manifestation of that single problem. What are the implications for China's political stability? Well, I give a lot of speeches talking about the growth outlook for China, and I'm very optimistic about it. And in that context, I say the main risks, to my mind, would come from a major political shock or perhaps from some major environmental catastrophe. or some combination of both. But you can see that there's the possibility of a major political shock. The problem is you have to assign a probability to it. There's a possibility of all sorts of things happening in the world, but what is the probability? And my feeling is that on what we know today, even though the system is so opaque, I think it comes back to the point about hanging together or hanging separately. At the end of the day, I would still assign a low probability to a major political shock. A low probability to the dots being joined between all these many, many thousands of what they call mass incidents, many thousands of mass incidents. And partly the trick there is economic growth. Income inequality, arbitrary behaviour, corruption. My feeling is all accommodated by people whilst the economy is growing so quickly. And you are looking at an economy that's doubling per capita income every 6 or 7 years. It's phenomenal. And at the end of the day, that seems to be enough. Now, growth will slow at some point, but I think, as I said, I'm very optimistic. I can see China's aggregate GDP doubling this decade and doubling again next decade. So we're talking about an economy four times bigger than what it is today in 20 years. And so that's going to give a tremendous amount of stability to balance against the sources of instability.
There's a question. Yes, sir.
I think I understood you to say that we don't really understand how the parties operate in China, the various political systems. Why is that so, that we don't understand and can't follow it? And what are we going to do about it? And is it all right to just leave it, or should we be really moving ahead?
It's a very good question. It's not that we understand nothing, and I hope I set out my presentation that some of the things we know, and I don't want to try and repeat Rumsfeld's what's knowable and unknowable and knowing unknowns, but it is an extraordinary thing that the system is still opaque. If you read Richard McGregor's book on the party, he brings together what we all know, and those of us who deal with China know that, you know, the three powerful institutions inside the party, the organisation department, which assigns people jobs all over the country from the very top down to the lowest levels of party officials. The Inspection and Discipline Committee is extremely powerful, and interestingly enough, that reports directly to Xi Jinping, the Vice President, which is another indication of his power in the system. And then the people do, you know, anti-corruption investigations on party members, and they know where all the bodies are buried, and so that's extremely powerful. And the third one's the propaganda department. And so they're the three legs of party control and power. And then, of course, sitting outside the party, although they're all party members at the senior levels, the PLA, and then you've got the security forces and so on. But it's the dynamics between people inside that we don't know. And it's still a very secretive world, and it's been maintained secretive. There's any number of highly qualified academics who peer into it, who make better than educated guesses, but the fundamental point is we can't peer into the centre of it to really understand. We don't know who really lines up with each other on the standing committee, the current nine. If you look at the Australian cabinet, you've got a pretty good idea who lines up where on any policy issue. You've got no idea with the nine, and never will. So one day maybe it'll all come out, but I think we have to be realistic about how little we know. But that doesn't mean we know nothing about how the system's operating.
There was a question right down the back. Yes?
Michael Feller from the Institute. You mentioned that if not a political shock, change for the worse could come via an environmental shock. Bearing in mind that throughout China's history, dynasties have often fallen on famine or environmental catastrophe, bearing in mind that we have extraordinarily high food inflation in China, and bearing in mind that Beijing will apparently run out of water unless this south-north water project is completed by 2014. What do you think the probability is of an environmental catastrophe happening in China in the next 5 or 10 years?
Again, look, I can't assign a scientific number to it, but my sense is pretty low. Because the good thing about people is there's a capacity to learn and capacity to apply technology and resources to solving these sorts of problems. One of the extraordinary things in the, well, it's longer than the 5 years I was in Beijing, but or have been there, but it's very much intensified in the last 5 years, is the greening of China. The whole country's been covered in trees. Beijing's a green city, once was called historically the Northern Dusty City. It's remarkable. That certainly goes to the issue of water, and water may be an absolute constraint, but of course there's other ways of supplying water. So I think what we've seen in the course of the last 5 or 6 years is a realisation at the centre that they have to fix these environmental problems, and over time, the last 5 years, I feel it's gone from rhetoric to real substance with real money and resources. I think the most likely place where big breakthroughs in green technology will take place in the world will be China. They have the purpose, the organisation to apply resources to these things, the economies of scale, and capital is very cheap. So I think we'll see a lot of big developments there. Nuclear power is going to be enormous, and that will eventually start to substitute for the consumption of coal. So these are all sort of technological fixes to a big problem, but I think policy is heading in the right direction, and that leads you then to the current 12th five-year plan, which just came out earlier this year, and that's got an emphasis on the two S's: structural adjustment, which is to take the weight of growth off fixed capital formation and exports and put it back much more on domestic household consumption, which tends to be more services and so less environmentally challenging, and sustainability, a very, very big thrust. And you look at the sustainability in the way you have, and I think that's a very valid way, but equally, you must remember there's been a profound change in China's existence in the past 15 years. China is actually a very rich country in terms of resources. It's got an enormous amount of iron ore, the world's largest coal, reserves as the world's largest coal producer and consumer. It goes on and on. Until 1997, it was self-sufficient in oil. But if you look from about that date, 97, when they moved to becoming a net oil importer, year after year, for every key resource or energy, China flips over dramatically from being largely self-sufficient or entirely self-sufficient or even a net exporter, as it was of coal up until about 2002, to becoming a major net exporter. And major net importer. Thanks, you're following me. You're just testing. Excellent, great. Major net importer. And I, part of sort of my fictional history of China, imagine that 5 years ago or so, one night in Zhongnanhai, one of the senior leaders just woke up in the middle of the night and started screaming at the ceiling in his darkened room, saying, "My God," or "My Chairman Mao, what have we done?" Because Deng Xiaoping's open door reform policies were never intended, in my view, to integrate China into the global economic system on the basis of Ricardian principles of comparative advantage. It was all about mercantilism. You export what you need to build your treasure, to import the technologies you need to then substitute inside your borders. And given you're a continental country of China's size, with huge markets, that, whatever the inefficiencies may be, that's quite a feasible policy objective, and they've done it. Basically, they've done it. What no one figured out, though, at the time, until quite recently, until after the fact, was that in making China richer, 1.3 billion people, when you're poor, China's resources actually went a long way. Once you make 1.3 billion people richer, then the resources suddenly diminish and you have to rely on the world. And so the resources issue for China is not a commercial issue as it is, say, for Australia. The resources issue is an issue of national security. And one reason why we always clash over these issues is because we see the world in fundamentally different terms. For us, we see resources trade as purely commercial transaction, no need to have government policy around it, nothing, it doesn't matter. For the Chinese, you know, they believe they're losing national sovereignty as a result of their dependence, so they will implement strategies to diversify sources of resource sources, no matter what the cost, because once it's seen as being an issue of national security and sovereignty, they'll pay any price. So this whole area is you know, is a different way we look at the world, be it from China's perspective or our own. So I think I digressed a bit from your question, but I think it's an important point to try and understand how very different this issue is for China than it is for us or other resource endowed economies.
Henry Bosch.
Could you say to what extent the Communist Party in China...
Just a second. Says that the people at the back can hear you.
Oh, sorry. Henry Bosch. Could you say to what extent the Communist Party in China still studies Marx or takes Marxist-Leninism seriously?
It is studied in the party schools. It is still regarded as a very important theoretical canon. I don't think it guides much policy or action, but it's part of the many, many strands legitimising the Communist Party. And so I think it's necessary. You couldn't sort of bury Marx, but it is moving into the realm of, if you like, interesting philosophy rather than you know, core thinking that underpins policy underpins policy development.
Professor Rady, without inviting close inspection, I think almost everything I'm wearing tonight was made in China. And I'd just be interested in your comments on labour costs. I've read an article a few weeks ago in the Melbourne Age which suggests that there is something changing in that area that may in fact be inviting a pressure towards a more appropriate level of wage in the Chinese manufacturing industry. Could you comment on that?
Yes, indeed. They passed a very important labour law, I think 2 years ago, it might be three now, which has substantially increased the cost of employing labour, and does tend to be enforced, and it's got social security provisions and leave provisions and so on. But what's happening, as often happens in China, is the policy runs in tandem to reinforce trends which are happening in any case because of the market. And all along eastern China, wages and incomes are rising very, very rapidly. There are many big cities, some most people here may never have heard of, like Qingdao or Dalian. Most of you have heard of Qingdao, that's where the beer comes from, and Dalian and places like that, that now have, you know, per capita incomes way over $10,000. And wage costs are rising very rapidly on eastern China. But more and more areas of China are being brought into production as rural urban migration proceeds. That's why the second and third tier cities have emerged as such significant economic entities. Rural urban migration and then the migration of manufacturing from higher east coast areas to lower wage interior areas. Plus, the rollout of massive transport infrastructure is substantially reducing internal barriers to trade through reducing transport costs, and in doing so is knitting together a continental size economy into a single economy. The province of Sichuan, where it had nearly 100 million people, was once in time an extremely wealthy province because it was a breadbasket of China, and it could bear the transport costs. Salt, for example, was worth more than gold to the late 19th century. So production in Sichuan could bear very high transport costs. But then later on in the 20th century, Sichuan became one of the poorest economies because it was so isolated from the rest of China, and the things it produced were produced in abundance. And so its incomes didn't rise, or under the planning system, the sorts of things it produced were sold on very repressed prices. The point I'm making is that you're getting these very powerful trends, and it's really like economic geography first year. Industry's relocating where wages are cheaper and where regulatory arrangements are more accommodating. The iPad's a very interesting experience. All Apple iPhones are made in Shenzhen, and they're made by the Taiwanese company Foxconn, and they employ, I don't know, at the last count, maybe 90,000 people or something. Incredible concentration of electronics manufacturing in Shenzhen. iPhone went there, disciplined workforce, cheap labour, when it started, how many years ago. But now the iPad, the new consumer product, is all made in Chengdu in the far west of China, because it's valuable enough to bear transport costs, but transport costs are also falling, and there's a cheaper but disciplined workforce. So there's a real spread of production going on. Also out of China, a lot of labour intensive, low value added manufacturing is, you know, moving to Bangladesh or Vietnam or elsewhere. But the other interesting thing, if you look at the east coast of China, is that it's going through a rapid transformation of its manufacturing away from low valued labour intensive manufacturing to, you've guessed it, higher valued, more capital intensive manufacturing. And so many provinces up the east coast of China are starting to take on the characteristics of what we once called, when I was a boy in the 1980s, newly industrialising economies, NICs. And this is a market-driven phenomenon, but policy settings overlay that to really, you know, accelerate the speed at which that sort of structural adjustment takes place.
Is there a question? Yes, you.
Julie Moon from the Institute. I'm just interested in international rather than domestic affairs at the moment. We had a speaker from Princeton recently at the Institute talking about, who posited the theory that China was systematically and had a systematic strategy to move country by country to exclude the sphere of influence of the US in Eastern Asia and through the South Pacific. And I wondered if you'd like to comment on that, and particularly on the domination perhaps of China in our trade route area.
I'll profess up front to have a much more sanguine view on that subject. I know there's a lot of concern in some more conservative think tanks and in the minds of some more conservative writers here in Australia, somehow China has a grand plan to peel us off from the United States. But I don't subscribe to that for a couple of reasons. One, and if you read Kissinger's book on China, which has just come out, I think it's really very good. A lot of the Sinologists are jumping up and down, waving their arms about it, but the reality is Kissinger actually was there, he did it, and he knew a lot of these people, and he thinks deeply about these subjects and issues. And why I say that, one of the themes, strong themes, that comes out of Kissinger's book on China is just how pragmatic Chinese foreign policy setting is. And all I can say is, from my own personal experience, that's how I see it. And so I don't think people in China really want to waste time or effort in trying to achieve the impossible, which is to peel us off from the United States. I just don't see that as part of the grand plan. If you look at countries much closer to China, less rusted on to the United States than we are, then that's, I think, a legitimate area of contest for China with the United States. But their execution has been deplorable, if that really is the strategy, because after how they dealt with the Daiichi Islands issue with Japan, the North Korean sinking of the South Korean patrol boat, and then the South China Sea, what's happened is that all the neighbouring countries have sought to embrace the United States even more firmly. So even if some guys in China had that as an idea, I think it would be an immensely difficult strategy to execute. And all these states have historical experience of being tribute states to China. So on one hand, that type of close relationship is not historically unprecedented for them, but they all have a very deep suspicion about just the extent to which China can distort their policy choices and options. The other point I'd say about China is, actually, I'd make up a book, but it's a very good point and question to raise. China's principal security concern, as I see it, is its land borders. Always has been and always will be. So when you sit in Beijing, you don't really think about Southeast Asia, you don't really think about the Pacific, other than the big gorilla on the other side, the United States. You certainly don't think about Australia. And I must say, I one of my farewell calls saw one of the top think tank guys in the strategic field and said, well, we're having a farewell lunch. One question I've always wanted to ask, but I thought was a bit indelicate as an ambassador, but I'll ask it to you now, is how much do you think about Australia in terms of your strategic interests and outlook? And he looked at me and said, not at all. That's because they know where we stand, they know we line up with the US, they don't actually have to spend time thinking about Australia's positions on these things.
Poor Kevin.
So it's a different world view. Another anecdote, if you like, you know, we were trying to get into this ASEM, Europe-Asia summit, something I was vaguely caught up with in 1996, and then neither the Europeans nor the Asians wanted us in, and we saved a lot of officials' airfares and things by not joining. Suddenly this became the thing we had to do a couple of years ago, and the world had moved on, and Europeans didn't sort of care, and the Asians didn't really care, and the organisation had not done anything since we last tried to get in 15 years earlier or something. And someone rang me up in my office one night from Canberra, because we were really, really, really pushing to get in. And I'd been reporting the Chinese view, which, you know, they couldn't care if Australia was in or not, and they're not a problem, they're not an obstacle. And someone breathlessly rang and said, we've just heard from, I better not say, a small Southeast Asian country, that it's really the Chinese that are going around blocking us. And I said, look, please just calm down. I can assure you tonight in Beijing, there is not one soul lying awake thinking about how to keep Australia out of ASEAN. Not one. But I can bet you that there are a lot of souls in small ASEAN countries who are thinking nothing else. Because China is a great power. And so when you think about China, you have to move beyond how we think and view the world to try and put yourself in the shoes of a great power. I don't mean that in a normative sense. I don't mean a good power. I mean it's a great power, great weight in the world. And if it wants to be in a club, it will be in a club. But if it's not in a club, then the club's not worth having in any case if China's not there. So it takes a very different view of the world. Now that leads on to US-China relations, which is probably the real point of your question. That's a very important topic. Again, I'll declare my hand. I'm fairly sanguine about it. I accept all the anxiety people express in think tanks and so on about the potential for conflict, because you have an emergent power and the existing power has to cede strategic space. That goes without saying. And when that happens, the potential for conflict is enormous. But what I would like people to think about is how well US and China have managed the relationship since the establishment of diplomatic relations in 1970, since Nixon's visit in 1972 or 3, and since the establishment later of formal diplomatic relations. They've been through crises on the Korean Peninsula, they've been through crises over Taiwan with the DPP, they've been through crises over arms sales to Taiwan, they've been through human rights differences, they've been through any number of issues, and they've managed crises and tensions well. Now, sure, it may get harder as China gets bigger and stronger, I accept that, but the one thing that struck me in Beijing as ambassador was the depth of the US-China relationship, the layers, the interaction, the contact. I never would find a top think tank official or academic who wasn't getting on a plane to go to Washington or getting off a plane from Washington. The numbers of bilateral arrangements they have. Obviously, for both Washington and Beijing, their respective relationship is the single most important thing in the world for them now, and that won't change. it means that countries like Australia, we have to, you know, play our hand even harder to get notice and get attention. And I felt that that was one of the biggest challenges in Beijing, was to be noticed, because the engagement with the United States is so deep and complex and multi-layered. Now, it's in Australia's interest that the US and China are like that, even if we're crowded out from attention. That's why, notwithstanding all the risks and potential for conflict, I'm actually fairly sanguine that Washington and Beijing will continue to manage that relationship as it goes through now a period of quite a lot of adjustment.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, time has marched on, and I want to make two things pretty clear. Firstly, it's going to be my very great pleasure to move a vote of thanks to Geoffrey. And secondly, please don't stand up and rush off as soon as that's finished, because there are some very important announcements to make. But it really is a particular pleasure to move this vote of thanks to the Professor, because I have heard, strangely enough, Professor, over the years, some criticism of ambassadors from time to time. What on earth were they doing? They had all those marvellous places to live and all those people looking after them. But when you hear somebody with the depth of knowledge and experience and the advice that a person like Geoffrey can give to the government of the day, no matter what complexion that government is, you realise how valuable a person like Geoffrey is as Australia's representative overseas. You have demonstrated tonight a tremendous knowledge of the subject on which you have addressed us, and I'm sure we are, well, I'm totally certain, we are very much better informed and hopefully a little bit wiser as well. So would you join me, ladies and gentlemen, in endorsing this vote of thanks to the Professor for a marvellous evening.